Just like I said, we're back. It's a Taylor Report at CIA 2. It's 89.5 FM. And with me is Phil Conlon. We just told you Phil's show is going to be on May 14th. It's going to be on at 6 p.m. It's classical.
6 p.m. on Wednesdays, yes.
What did I say?
No, that's it. Yeah, just okay. Right now we're on Tuesdays.
I ask what did I say because I'm never listening. But anyhow.
That's all right, Phil. We all listen to you, and it usually makes sense.
Somebody will know what it is. You know the story about George Bush Sr. went into the, in Miami, was campaigning for votes, and he went into an elderly home for the elderly, and he walked up to two women, and he said, "How do you do? Excuse me, do you know who I am?" And they said, "No, dear, just go to the front, they'll tell you." I take that as a true story from here on. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, and we are joined, I believe, by Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. Are you there, sir?
No.
No?
How are you doing?
Very good. And we're really glad to be talking to you today. Norman is quite well known throughout the city. He's currently working as a producer of Saturday Morning Live and on Radio Regent. And he can be heard on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. His column, Diasporic Music, appears monthly on the Burning Spear, in the Burning Spear newspaper, known as the Voice of International African Revolution, is a print and online newspaper. The paper is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence and has published without interruption since the 1960s. That's Saturday Morning Live, radio.wordpress.com and radioregent.com and hurunews.com / radio. We're remembering, we want to ask you, Norman, about Reuben Carter. And you got to know Reuben Carter, and I noticed in an article that you met him at the time of the release of Spike Lee's film, Malcolm X. Tell us about that, and what's your impression of Reuben Carter?
Well, I met him in 1992. I guess it was late 1992 at a theater. I came to see the film. I believe I was by myself, or I was with my son. Mm-hmm. And he was coming out of the theater, and he was with the Canadians, Lisa and Paula and Sam and that crew.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit it off, and they started inviting me to their they had a place in King City.
Mm-hmm.
And every Sunday, Reuben would pick myself and my son up. My son at that time was five or six.
Uh-huh.
And we would go there, and we would watch Gil Noble, the show like it is religiously. That was a show that came out of New York on every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they would always have good, wholesome food, and we would talk about world affairs.
Uh-huh.
And listen to, music. The Canadians were basically blues people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We would listen to a lot of great music, and Reuben Carter was a big fan of Clyde McFadder.
Uh-huh.
And they were working on the script at that particular time, and they wanted me to do the music for the film. And
The Hurricane.
Yeah, for The Hurricane. And of course, that did not happen because there were some complications with the script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they basically, Hollywood, so yeah. They really lost control, and you know how those big producers, they had their people, and, you know, the girlfriend's business, and that kind of stuff. So, I got shut out of that project, but I remember when the soundtrack came out, Reuben delivered it to me, to my door, you know.
Well.
And I know it was, a lot of good music was on it.
Before we ask you about the music, I got to ask you this. The two of you met looking at Malcolm X, the Spike Lee film. So what did he think of that film?
He was not that crazy about it because he had known Malcolm personally, and I think it was a little bit too much jitterbugging it. You know, it was like a friend of mine, Sam Anderson, said it was like Roger Rabbit colorized, you know. And, you know, like Malcolm...
I'm going to have to think about that.
Malcolm went to Harlem, and then he went to Egypt, rode a camel, mm-hmm. went to Mecca,
mm-hmm.
Came back to Harlem, and he never left Harlem. And, you know, Fidel was left out. I guess we can understand that. But, I mean, there was no...
Yeah, we're supposed to understand. You're right.
With Nkrumah, you know, mm-hmm. Malcolm went to Africa, and he met with, you know, most of the world leaders at that particular time.
Well, I think he met Nyerere, right, in Tanzania?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Babu.
Yeah. Oh, and, my gosh. You know, by the way, to understand him, obviously you have to mention those people.
Right.
I mean, it's really not fair. By the way, can you imagine the pressure that came down on Spike Lee making that himself? He must have got a lot of phone calls.
He had to, first of all, he got support. First of all, let me say that I think that our position was a minority position because I think most people loved the film. I didn't. I wasn't that crazy about it, but I'm just saying. Most people saw it as a, you know, like a introduction to Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
and Rubin was not that crazy about the film, no.
Uh-huh. Now, but you say he had known Malcolm. Now, was that when he was a prize fighter, or had he known him as when he was in prison? What was that contact?
I remember him talking about how Malcolm would speak and. You know, like when Malcolm spoke, it would be like, I don't want to use Michael Jackson as an example, but it would be just like a Luther Vandross concert. Uh-huh. He said, like, after Malcolm spoke, it would, and they collected lots of money, and he said at Malcolm's door, they had, there would be women at his door, and he had lots of money, and there was a lot of people that wanted, you know, to uh-huh. take some of the money, and if they were not going to take it, then Malcolm said, okay, no one's going to take any of this money. This money belongs to, you know, the Nation of Islam, blah, 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 blah. And they would have all these women at mm-hmm. the door, you know, women looking like Angela Bassett, some of them looking like Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
And the brothers would say, you know, Malcolm, if you're not going to hit it, let me hit it. And mm-hmm. Malcolm says, no, it's not going to be any of that. So he said that basically caused so much friction because Malcolm was uncorruptible. So that caused... Mm-hmm. That was a lot of problems.
That's a great story. This comes from Reuben Hurricane Carter, an observation of that he made.
Oh yeah, but I mean he made those observations to me in, you know, sort of
mm-hmm.
private type situations. I don't know if he went public with that kind of stuff. And we watched the Million Man March together, and he was not that impressed with the Million Man March because, you know, Minister Farrakhan didn't put any demands on the system. It was basically the whole question of absolving, you know. Well, he let the system off the hook, you know. Because
mm-hmm.
we spent that whole day together and we watched the, I think it was on CNN, and mm-hmm. you know, thousands.
That's where I watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
That was a powerful moment for sure. And I'm very impressed that Reuben Carter was studying what was going on. And he, by the way, he did approach everything basically critically, right? He wanted to know what was going on and who was behind things and that sort of thing. He very critical.
Oh, he was very critical of very, very critical of everything, walking and talking, right?
In the old days, when he was wearing gloves, he not only was critical, he took it apart, right?
Oh, yeah.
We should remind everybody, he was a middleweight contender. He was within range of becoming a champion. He certainly fought Joey Giardello, who was probably the greatest middleweight of that time. And so he was going to be around if they hadn't come after him. I'm going to ask you about something. I keep saying we're going to talk about music, but I've got to ask you this. He said to you, who do you think should play me in the movie? And you had some interesting nominations. You thought Michael Wright should play him.
Well, Michael Wright was a guy who played Eddie in the Five Heartbeats,
uh-huh.
and I I really like Michael Wright, and I also said Wesley Snipes.
Wesley Snipes. Well, what did you see in, tell us about the man, Michael Wright. What did you see in him? What is it that makes you think that he would be the guy to play
He's American very Heart? Intense. Very, 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 very intense. Mm-hmm. And he is has almost as much melanin as Ruben.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very intense guy. If you see his role he played in the Five Heartbeats, he was just an intense person. So I thought, yeah, he could have pulled it off. Wesley Snipes would have been perfect too.
By the way, we of course we Denzel Washington is one of the great actors, but the it is interesting. The Hollywood system is they once they've got your script and they're thinking about it. Then they want to know.
Oh, they were looking for a big name. And I, first
yeah.
of all,
who's going to sell the tickets for us, right?
Yeah.
In other words, if you give them a great young black actor, intense, got all the qualities. Yeah, but is anybody going to buy tickets? That's all they
want to
know.
Oh, that's all they want to know. But I think Denzel Washington, he carried it off beautifully. Yeah, he did it. I have no criticism of.
No, he was a great. He was a great Malcolm. He played Malcolm very well.
He should have won an Academy Award for Hurricane, but he waited until he played a corrupt cop and gave it to him, you know.
Yeah. I thought that was a nice observation. By the way, Norman, I'm working, of course, from this article. Has this article been printed yet?
It was in the Caribbean Camera, and it was also printed in Sri Lanka, in the Nation in Sri Lanka, believe it or not.
Okay, the title is My Moments with Ruben Carter by Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. Let's make sure people go and get a copy of that. Caribbean Camera.
Yes.
Those of you who are in Sri Lanka, of course, you can pick it up there. But
in Sri Lanka, you can get the Sri Lankan article. You can go on the web and...
Go on the web.
Go on the web and you can see it, right.
What's the site for that?
Oh, it's just The Nation of Sri Lanka.
Uh-huh.
Just say that, you know, just put in The Nation Sri Lanka and it would come up. The name of the newspaper is The Nation, and it's from
Colombo,
the country of Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka. And this is Norman Otis Richmond. And now, you mentioned in this, of course, we have to talk about music. You mentioned that his liking of Clyde McFadder, and it seemed you remarked on it that he wished he'd met Clyde. Hurricane Carter, had not had a chance to meet him, but you tell us about Clyde McFadder, because there's more to him than just the music.
Oh, well, Clyde McFadder was a great singer, and he was very conscious. He was a race man, as they would say. He was a lifelong member of the NAACP, and at that time, being in the NAACP, as far as the racists in America were concerned, he might as well have been in the the Black Panther Party or the Communist Party.
Yeah, or Robespierre. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was not religious because his father had been a preacher, and he thought his father was a hypocrite, and he said, you know, that religion was, he called it hocus pocus, and mm-hmm. he didn't like the way his father treated his mother.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it was he was basically a rebel, and he basically, like I said, he pulled Sam Cooke's coat to, you know, what was happening in a lot of situations. And you know, Clyde McFadder had a problem with booze, and you know, I guess when his popularity went down, he lost it, you know, and he never really made the money that he should have made, you know. But he was inspired a lot of singers.
Yeah, you mentioned
Smokey
Sam
Robinson.
Cooke. Yes.
Sam Cooke, yeah. But he had he sang White Christmas by the Drifters, and you know, White Christmas is one of the biggest songs of all time. And all of those Hollywood movies, if you listen to what's the little guy's name? DiCaprio, when he was playing those little Christmas movies when he was a kid. White Christmas is whoever wrote it. I don't know if Clyde's people are getting any money off of it, but whoever wrote it and whoever published it, you know, that's White Christmas.
Well, that gives
but
me.
He did it with the Drifters.
You give me the perfect intro because you saw Reuben Hurricane Carter playing Santa Claus himself. I guess it was a White Christmas because it was in Canada.
Yeah, and he was.
Now that's a story.
He had a Santa Claus outfit on, a lot of melanin and a lot of kids, and he was in his element. You know, we just playing Santa Claus for the kids. You know, and they loved it. And they showered people with gifts. There was a group of people from New Jersey, you know, and my relatives were up here, and it was just a good time, you know.
Yeah.
They fed everybody, gave everybody presents. Reuben played kind of Santa Claus, and it was Christmas of I guess it was 93, right?
Yeah. Well, I had a couple of three short encounters with him, and whenever I saw him, he was a person who just brought a lot of energy and intensity, so that you sort of felt it when you're in the room. So if he played Santa Claus, I bet he was a great Santa Claus.
Oh, he was.
But
yeah,
the kids loved that.
They loved it. And I guess to see an African Santa Claus was not an everyday thing.
Yeah. Now, this is Norman Otis Richmond. I got to ask, you know, when we think about it, his life, all those years in prison, and much of it, if my memory's right, was solitary confinement. Am I right?
Yes.
I mean, that has got to lead, whether anybody wants to put a name on it, to something akin to post-traumatic stress. They tell us that solitary confinement is actually torture. And yet, so can you talk about how he was able to handle all that? I mean, most of us, I think, would not be in terribly good shape and not be able to lead anti-racist struggles and not be able to help prisoners who are locked up in organized campaigns.
Well, he said he was not in. He was not. He came up as a Christian because his father was big in the church, and he was very sympathetic towards Islam because he was in prison with a brother. He was exposed to Islam when he was in Europe in the military. Mm-hmm. And he had I think his Muslim name was Saladin Muhammad. Saladin is in people familiar with Islam was a warrior, so they had named him, I think, was Saladin Abdullah Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
But he never really accepted Islam, but he basically said that he believed in something called the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically psyched himself up that he was not in prison and wouldn't go along with the program. And I think it took its toll on him because he was, you know, he had a lot of problems in terms of maintaining relationships with a lot of people. Like he broke with the Canadians, and he broke with a lot of people.
The last organization he was prominently associated with earned worldwide reputation, and they do. By the way, they do. All people remarking on it said it was his input, his inspiration and drive that made them successful in winning the freedom for people wrongfully convicted.
Right. Well, Innocence International was his last organization, but he was with AIDWIC. That was the organization that propelled internationally, because he went all over the world for AIDWIC, right?
Mm-hmm. This is Norman Otis Richmond, and by the way, it is Saturday Morning Live Radio .wordpress.com, Radio Regent .com, Uhuru News .com /radio. Now, Norman, you interviewed John Artis, and his name needs to come up because he was arrested along with Reuben Hurricane Carter way back, and he did a lot of prison time himself. You were speaking. He came up, I understand, when the hurricane began to suffer from prostate cancer, and looked after him. What did he have to tell you?
I spoke to him a few minutes ago, just before I spoke to you. He was supposed to be on my radio show yesterday, and something happened. He didn't.
Ah.
He did do G97.8, the Stephen Harper station.
Yeah.
And there was a big mix up. I hope to get him on there pretty soon. But mm-hmm. he basically said that Ruben is like, you know, about 8 years older than he was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were basically talking a few minutes ago how, you know, Ruben would be driving around. He would play these Otis Redding song over and over and over. And John was laughing about saying, you know, hey, man, put on some funk, you know, some up-tempo stuff, you know. And Ruben would be driving, and Ruben would say, you know, this is my car. So basically shut the F up. It's just, I know, I'm in charge. So he was basically saying that when he was in his car driving, he would play jazz and tell Ruben the same thing. You know, it's like, okay, this is George Benson, Ruben. This is David Sanborn. This is, you know, this is my stuff. You're in my car. So, and they would laugh about that, you know. But
well, I'm glad he got to the laughing part.
Oh, no, Ruben. Ruben laughed all the time.
He did. He had a great smile. His photographs are terrific. They're electric. He lit the place up, actually.
Well, you know who else used to laugh? And some people used to criticize him for laughing so much, was Huey P. Newton.
I'm saying it again. I'm sorry.
I say a lot of people some people criticize Huey because they say Huey P. Newton laughed all of the time. You know.
Well, you know. Laughter is a cousin of that other sentiment.
Well, Malcolm laughed all the time, too. Malcolm X, yes. And, you know, Martin Luther King privately laughed, but, you know, when he was on Martin Luther King Spoke, you would think he was serious as a heart attack. But, you know, I understand behind the closed doors, he was quite a character. But, yeah, but Reuben Carter was, he said what John said, that he liked, one of the reasons he liked John so much, because John made him laugh all the time, you know.
We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, and the article is in the Caribbean.
Camera.
Pardon me?
Caribbean Camera.
Caribbean Camera, I've got to say. Yes, Caribbean Camera. By the way, of course, Norman, you find it Saturday morning live, radio.wordpress.com, radioregent.com, uhurunews.com. Incidentally, Norman, you're about to go, you're headed for an event right now, aren't you? What is that?
Oh, we're getting ready to show a film called Mama Africa, with a film about Marion McCabe. We're at 38 Regent Street. Regent Park.
Uh-huh. By the way, I'll just finish on that. A hurricane must have wanted to kind of get around and see these. Did he get to travel much? Because I think about South Africa, someone like Marion McCabe and all the hurricane.
He did some travel because, you know, Mandela, his last book, Nelson Mandela wrote the foreword for him. But he spent time in Jamaica. He spent time in Georgia. He spent time in Europe, Australia, and so on and so forth. Yeah, he did some. He did quite a bit of traveling.
I'm glad I asked you that, because now I'm remembering a very enthusiastic Nelson Mandela shaking Reuben Hurricane Carter's hand. There's a great photograph. People could just Google that.
I've never seen that photograph.
It is really, you know, Nelson Mandela wanted to be a prize fighter.
Right.
He wanted to be, I'll bet he wanted to be Jack Johnson. He understood the significance of being the heavyweight champion of the world.
Champion of the world, right.
You remember the argument between Arthur Ashe and the American broadcaster, I forget his name, Howie Cosell. And Howie Cosell said the greatest moment for black Americans was Jackie Robinson. And Arthur Ashe said, no, it wasn't.
It was
Jack Johnson. And Cosell said, what? Yeah. So Nelson Mandela would agree, and Nelson Mandela would have voted for Hurricane Carter. Otis Richmond, thank you very, very much. Nice talking to you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye. That's Norman Otis Richmond. And it is a great story. Phil, do you remember it, by the way? Did you see the film The Hurricane, by the way?
I haven't seen it. I have to say that even before I came to Canada, I knew Hurricane Carter. He was an exciting fighter, and he was one of those fighters that kept interest in boxing alive for me when I was in that young age group, and you know, was mostly a baseball fan. But I came from a family with a father who was devoted to boxing, and
big deal.
And Carter was a big deal. And then when he ended,
of course, you had the ancestry, right, Irish, yeah, and Italian, both, yeah, you know, Rocky Marciano.
Absolutely. When Carter got arrested and got in trouble with the police, and it was so disheartening because, of course, you would read the New York Times, and you know, which of course never gets anything right, but it takes a lifetime to realize that. You should never believe what you read in the New York Times. They really made him look like a criminal. They said, look at this wild, out-of-control animal. Now we're really seeing what he really is and stuff like, yeah, that. And, of course, you know, as the story developed over the years, you realize that the whole thing was completely made up by the police. There was he had absolutely nothing to do. He wasn't even close. Yeah. To the events which led him to being in jail, and it's so horrible when you think about
then
that.
Then you combine it. The obvious is black and has opinions. Yeah. Yeah. He was one of those rare individuals in the world of sport, but particularly in the world of boxing, who spoke up. I don't know whether he was inspired by Muhammad Ali. Ali certainly affected a lot of lives, and he had this idea that you get to be free, you have to ask for permission to have an opinion. But you would be, everybody had to be broken, to use the expression Ishmael Reed. Speaking of black Americans,
yes, yeah,
the important thing is once one, they speak up or challenge power, white power, then they had to be a ritual
and
breaking.
I think that's something about which makes Carter, you know, a real legendary hero, is they never broke him. You know, I mean, they injured him, they ruined his life, but they never broke him, and that's something that you can't
ruin
admire
your maid. You know, by the resistance becomes what it is. Will you maintain this point of view or not? Mm-hmm. If you maintain it, you win.
Well, in that case, he won. He was the champion, absolutely, because he maintained it, and he still maintained it. And you know, I want to remember the issue that made him break with the group here. It's when, you know, the group here, they were nice enough people, and they weren't interested in the issues of innocent people. But when a particularly obnoxious, arrogant crown attorney got appointed a judge, and they wanted to send him a letter, said, well, congratulations, good luck being a judge. And Carter said, no, that guy's never apologized for what he's did in putting innocent people in jail.
I think it's a woman, actually. Wasn't it the woman, the prosecutor?
I think it was. I have another guy in mind.
Isn't it
you
fun?
Might be right.
We'll have everybody scratching
right.
their
it
heads.
It was a crown attorney who became a judge, which
right.
to me, even
who
that
had
is.
Prosecuted
is,
Moran,
is,
wasn't it?
That's right. And even that, by the way, is very problematic because then you spend your life trying to put people in jail whether they did anything wrong or not. And then you get to be the one, you get promoted to be the one who sits in judgment. And of course, the prosecutors are all your old colleagues, right? Yeah. So that is a very corrupt system, too. And, and he would point things like that out. Is it the whole thing stinks?
You know? Well, certainly that's the problem with membership. And, you know, you're a member, and particularly if you're identified, and a majority decides to do something, you have to resign. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it, by the way. After all, it's a difference of opinion. But we have the phenomenon, particularly in politics today. Actually, nobody resigns anymore.
Because nobody has any shame.
We talked about this case of jumping back to Murray Daba and Victoria Nuland. She's captured on air making an obscene remark about the heck with Europe, the European Union. But there's no resignation. Nobody says, well, you know, that obviously you shouldn't have said that. And then you on your side should say, you're right, I hurt the team, I should step down. But when you stay there, you figure, well, the team actually wanted you to do that. I mean, that's why people do have to show some
wanted you to
integrity.
Say that and wanted people to hear it.
Yeah,
they
knew
you
again.
Said it, yes.
Yeah. So it is kind of important that stands be taken. And by the way, that might inspire other people to do the right thing as well. And so anyway, I'm glad you called attention to that. I'm glad we talked about Hurricane Carter. Brian, next week I hope we'll get into a discussion with friends Dan Heap, who was a great guy. The last time I met Dan, we both rode together over to Hamilton for a meeting protesting, I think, the bombing of Iraq. I have to tell you, Dan was in so many struggles, it might have been something else. I'll try to pinpoint it when we get back. So you've been listening to The Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to thank Carol and Phil Conlon, and we'll see you next week.